from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll have a special extended interview with Greg Charleston, president of the Arts Council of Indianapolis, a position he's leaving this summer after years of leadership. I'll also take a look at the new George Rickey Public Art Project with Mindy Taylor Ross.
And of course, we'll have our arts calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Greg Charleston is best known by his current title, President of the Arts Council of Indianapolis, a position he's leaving this summer after years of leadership. Sharon Gamble invited Greg into our studios to ask him about his many years of arts advocacy in our state, as well as his new adventure in Florida.
I remember asking you this when you took the helm at the Arts Council several years ago, but how did you know, as a student, a college student or a young adult, that arts administration was going to be in your path?
Wow. You know, I'm not sure that I did know that. The arts were always a big part of my life growing up and something I was very interested in, passionate about, and had played a very influential part of my life. But I really sort of came into it in terms of writing and marketing and PR and got into arts administration that way. Didn't really study it and didn't really intend to work in public administration, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Your family was supportive, took you to concerts, plays, or was that something you kind of fell in love with through school?
Yeah, you know, really a combination of both. My family was very musical oriented, and so there was
Do you play or sing?
I don't. Now, unfortunately, the music part is not part of my specialties, but certainly my father and my brothers. You know, it was always a part of my life growing up. And then through school, you know, actually I grew up in the Indianapolis public school system. And so the Indianapolis Symphony's music memory program mm-hmm. was a big part of what I remember growing up, and field trips to the IMA and the Children's Museum. And, yeah, they were very influential for me.
So it is possible to raise a thoroughly cultured person in Indianapolis, if anybody had any doubts.
Absolutely.
So, starting out on the writing side and the marketing side, what was your first experience in public administration?
I worked at the Indiana Arts Commission first, sort of came out of journalism school and worked as a reporter, and then worked at the Indiana Arts Commission doing marketing and public relations, and started getting very interested in the grant making and the mechanisms of a state agency and how that operates. So that was really my first experience with the arts and with the public side of supporting the arts.
Was there something specific that intrigued you about grant making?
Well, I think that you saw just the benefits of how important the funding was to individuals, to organizations all across the state. You know, it was in very small towns where the money had a profound impact on whether or not a theater company survived or whether a certain program happened. And sometimes those small grants to libraries or multi-service centers were the only exposure that people had to the arts in those communities. So you saw everything from that to, you know, certainly Indianapolis and all that it had to offer here, and the huge impact that the arts had and the grants had for educational programs and outreach programs. And I think I just saw, you know, this is really important. This is meaning a lot to a lot of people.
Was there any cross-pollination between your experience as a reporter and what you went on to do at the Arts Commission?
Sure. I think that, you know, to me, writing, reporting is all about telling a story. And really what we do in the arts every day, what I do is tell the story about the great arts community here, about the work that people are doing, about the importance, and whether that's with statistics or facts or economic impact numbers, or whether that's just with the anecdotes that we have. This is really about telling our story over and over and over again about how important it is. And so I think there's a real correlation between communication, whether that's, you know, talking to people or writing it or however that's done.
And, you know, that's an interesting perspective, too, because we tend to think of as a city agency or a state agency deals with big numbers and impact studies dealing with thousands right. of dollars, thousands of people, but it always does come back down to one person's experience at a time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's what's so important about the programs that not only the Arts Council supports, but all the public programs support on a state or regional or federal level, is that it really is affecting people one person at a time. And you think about like the after-school programs, for example, that we help support, the city helps support. If those go away, you don't know how many students are affected by those after-school programs, and does that keep one person interested in you know, positive activities, or two people, or five people, or 10 people, and however many that is, it really is impacting them one at a time.
Hmm. Do you have any favorite memories of stories of programs or people, the funds you've helped to distribute with your multiple hats on, have affected? Are there some people whose memories you'll cherish?
Oh, there are lots of them, and I probably, and on all different kinds of levels, you know, there are the people who are so passionate about starting their own companies. Or they were, you know, an artist themselves and wanted to take that bridge from being an artist to starting their own either dance company or performing company or small theater group, and to watch those kinds of organizations grow. And at times, it's very difficult to say, you know, well, you don't have the long range plan and the budgets and the audits and the finances to do all of this work. And I get that you're 110% passion, but, you know, zero business, and to watch that change and grow and develop. I have lots of memories, probably too many to even mention, about those kinds of things. And then just being part of the excitement, I think, of Indianapolis and watching that grow. The Indianapolis 2005 kind of campaign, which kind of brought to the forefront, the new Heron School of Art and the expansion at the IMA and the Eitelgeorg and the zoo and the Dinosphere at the Children's Museum, and, you know, all of those things coming online at the same time, and how exciting that was, really, and, you know, FYI's new building and all of these things that have happened. I think it's incredible to be part of that growth and development.
So you were with the Arts Commission for a number of years, mm-hmm. always in the marketing?
In the marketing initially, and then I was the assistant director for many years, and then kind of the acting director at the mm-hmm. time that I left to come to the Arts Council of mm-hmm. Indianapolis.
What did you learn by ascending through those positions, besides how hard it is? Maybe
I don't
that's
know.
What you learned.
It's lonely at the top. I don't
Absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely.
I just learned. I have such an appreciation for anybody who's in a position of trying to manage or lead organizations, and the responsibility that you feel. I felt a tremendous amount of responsibility, not only for the city funding and all the work that we're doing that affects other people, but also the fundraising for our own staff, and that I have, you know, a group of people who are depending on, you know, the activities that we do. And, you know, you never really get away from that responsibility that you kind of carry with you, anybody who is leading organizations. And I have a real appreciation for that.
And you can't say this about yourself, but I can say this. You have a long-term, stable staff at the Arts Council, which is unusual.
Yeah, we do. The, all of our senior staff members have been there from, you know, 6 to 10 years mm-hmm. each, and very, very stable staff.
Yeah, and that's to your credit to attract and keep good talent, because the astonishing amount of knowledge that walks out the door at the end of every day is irreplaceable.
It is. And, you know, they're a dedicated group of people, and there are lots of great people working in the arts in Indianapolis. But I think when you're in the service side of that, you know, you have to have a real dedication to wanting to help people. And, you know, I just spoke a second ago about, you know, watching organizations grow and develop. And I think for each one of our staff members, you know, they have watched the work of, you know, our artist services manager, Shannon Linker, has done a great job of really helping artists make a full-time living and find opportunities and become more professional in presentations. And, you know, watching the growth and development on all fronts is really an incredible, rewarding job.
Sharon Gamble with Greg Charleston, president of the Arts Council of Indianapolis. We'll be back with the second half of this interview in just a minute.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Art of the Matter. We now return to Sharon Gamble's interview with Greg Charleston, president of the Arts Council of Indianapolis.
What was the biggest change from leading a statewide organization to leading a city organization, or was that not much of a leap at all?
The biggest change probably just functionally is that the Arts Council is not a city agency. It's a private nonprofit. And we do re-grant the city's money, and we do have a number of city requirements related to the granting money, but not to the rest of our operations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest difference with the state is that you are a state agency, so you deal with, you know, state budget agencies and state departments of personnel and all kinds of things that really are out of your control. You know, you follow a set of rules and regulations that sometimes can be, you know, a bit overwhelming for a very small, you know, we had a very small organization of about 12 or 13 people, and the rules are written for organizations with, you know, 500 or 1,000. And, you know, so sometimes you do a lot of paperwork and rule following. And so that really, I think that helped us as the Arts Council, not being a city agency, helps you deliver those services a lot more quickly than you might otherwise.
But it also comes with the responsibility as a private, not-for-profit organization of needing to do the fundraising for the part that has nothing to do with the city tax dollars. And I think a lot of people don't know about that side.
Right. That's exactly right. All of our operations have to be raised independent of the city funding and the state funding that we receive. And, you know, the dilemma for an organization like the Arts Council is that you don't want to fundraise to compete against the very groups that you're trying to serve. And so we don't have a lot of fundraising efforts. We do foundation. We have very generous support from the Lilly Endowment and the Indianapolis Foundation and a number of other foundations in town. And we do very limited sort of corporate and individual fundraising, but that's it.
But man, that's tough too. If you to restate what you just said, you have to stay out of the pool of donors that the, you know, the Phoenix Theater, WFYI,
right,
the ISO, the IMA. You can't go to those sources, their sources of funding, because you can't cannibalize them.
Right. It's a very unique funding situation to be in. To say that you have, you know, X amount of budget that you have to meet and follow, and yet you really are sort of inherently restricted from these organizations to go and,
right,
and get that money. So
it's a good thing you have broad shoulders. This is a lot to do. But you're about to start a new chapter, which is really kind of an old chapter. You're going back to your writing roots.
Right.
So you're going to be teaching.
I am, yes. Part-time, English initially, and maybe journalism. At the Florida Keys College. It's a very small college in the Florida Keys, and I'm very excited about that because I haven't spent a lot of time not doing other kinds of administrative of work for 25 years. So I started out as a writer. I've always been interested in writing, and so to be able to dedicate myself to writing and then somewhat to teaching, I think will be a new experience for me.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Butler.
Mm-hmm.
Undergraduate and graduate both at Butler.
Homegrown.
Yeah.
We like that. Any Butler faculty or alums listening, we can be proud.
It's a great school.
It's a wonderful school and very strong in the humanities. Mm-hmm. Your degrees are in English and journalism?
Mm-hmm, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
So the writing that you want to do?
Playwright. I'm very interested in playwriting. I had written a number of works prior to sort of the leadership roles that I assumed at the Arts Council about 10 years ago, and I really wasn't able to continue writing and or trying to explore getting that work read and produced. So I'm anxious to kind of get back to that, and who knows, you know, other kinds of writing is now interesting to me too, so... I did a lot of magazine writing before, nonfiction writing, and feature kind of profiles. So I don't know what that will bring.
You know, I will attest that part of why you had no time to write was that every night of the week, it seems, you were out at somebody or other's event. And if you think about this, you and your staff, you and Dave Lawrence in particular, feel responsible for being supportive of all the not-for-profit arts organizations and individual artists. So if somebody's having a fundraiser, you're there. If somebody's having a gallery opening, you're there. If somebody's opening a new play, you're there. Do you worry at all about shifting gears and not having to be so public?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I think that I will miss it. There's no question for me that... attending these events and having people honestly, you know, so excited that you're there and care about being there is a huge part of the job that I will miss. But I think, on the other hand, it's time to let somebody else, you know, do some of that and to maybe be a little more introverted in my own life and get back to being an audience member again and start looking at things a little differently. You know, so many times lately it sort of gets wrapped into one and the other, and, you know, I go to a performance and then I'm seated with a city councilor and suddenly, you know, you're talking politics.
You're on the job.
You're on the job. And, you know, there's a part of me that will look forward to just sitting in the audience and letting the work sort of, you know, come back to me again.
You can sit in the audience and shed a tear if you need to.
That's exactly right.
And be incognito. What is the art scene like in the Keys?
Well, there's a lot of history, a lot of literary history, which is what attracted me to Key West in the first place on vacation about 10 years ago. And, of course, my house is like 6 blocks from Hemingway Studio.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, I can walk around and see where Tennessee Williams was and Robert Frost and, you know, all of these great writers for inspiration. So there's a huge literary history. There's some wonderful national writing seminars and workshops that take place in Key West. In addition to just the visual arts and the performing arts there too, but it's a fairly small town. So I would say the arts are an important part of Key West, but it is like any small town, limited in terms of its capacity.
And probably a swelling population when it's cold up here.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly right. Yes.
What do you want to be doing 5 years from now? Have you allowed your imagination free rein to go that far?
I know. You know, I think that I guess if we're talking about that I would like to dedicate myself to writing, I would like to think that, you know, in 5 years I might be successful in writing and, who knows, you know, have a play on Broadway or some merit of success in that arena. To be honest, I haven't really thought about, you know, how my life might be different without the public art side and the arts administration and, you know, what will consume my thoughts, you know.
You haven't had time.
I haven't had time yet, so I don't know. I may be better to answer that in a little bit.
Tell us about the first play you're going to work on. There's nothing like saying it publicly commit yourself.
I know. I don't know. I have a number of pieces that I did, as I said, about 10 years ago or started on 10 years ago that I think I will, as a way for me to start, you know, I think there's nothing worse than just sort of looking at the blank screen. And I think as a way to start, I will probably take some of those out of the drawer and see where I am 10 years later. With that, because I am quite sure that my experience and my worldview is a little different than it was 10 years ago. Even.
There's a little, you start your teaching in the fall, I
yes,
hope. So there's a little bit of a break, I'm going to use the V word, vacation.
Yes, there is. I know. I'm probably most excited about that at the moment. But yes, I will be finished in Indianapolis on July the 1st, and then I'll start teaching at the end of August. So I have about a good 6 weeks there. And so,
Time to unpack, shift gears,
and sort of get myself ready for that. And I think that I started working. I graduated on a Sunday from Butler, and I started my job at 8:30 on Monday morning the next day.
No, you did not.
I did. Now, at the time, I will say I was very lucky. I was one of the few graduates to actually get a job in my field and start, you know, the day after graduation. So I was, you know, I'm proud of that. But you know, in 25 plus years, you know, I probably haven't been off more than a week or 10 days ever. So to think that I might have 6 weeks off without doing something is pretty amazing.
We won't recognize you when you come back to visit.
All this gray hair I have will be gone.
Bleached by the sun,
bleached
by the ocean.
Bleached by the sun, that's right, that's right.
Sharon Gamble with Greg Charleston, president of the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Greg will be celebrated at a farewell party on June 25th at the Indianapolis Arts Garden. Well, Sharon, I've been thinking about our listeners.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mother's Day gets such a great buildup, and nobody forgets Mother's Day, or at least
no one
would ever admit to it. But, you know, Father's Day gets sort of pushed aside a little bit. So if you're listening to The Art of the Matter this weekend, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, I forgot Father's Day is Sunday, well, we've got some ideas of things that you can do with your father in the coming weeks that we will talk about on
What Do We Do? Dad's like art, too.
That's right.
It's not just a girly-girly thing. You are living proof. I'll bet
there
your cats
you
are going to give you some sort of gift certificate to something, some theatrical event or some concert here.
You just never know.
Yeah. Hey, you're going to have to give Dad a little gift certificate because you're going to go do this particular thing a little bit later. But what red-blooded American dad doesn't enjoy brass music? Find me one and I'll talk him into it. The Carmel Brass is going to celebrate the 4th of July on July 3rd. They're going to play in Carmel at 3:30 at the gazebo on Civic Square as part of Carmel Fest. And then they're going to take their instruments and pack them up and head on out to Greenfield for a 7 o'clock concert on the Hancock County Courthouse Plaza. So you can go to both concerts with Dad or just motor on over to one. And, of course, both concerts will be chock full of Independence Day All-American Classics. Carmel Brass, July 3rd, Carmel and Greenfield.
There's actually a couple cool concerts going on Father's Day. One down at the Madam Walker Theater. It's Clayton and Winbush are performing on Father's Day. And this features blues singer Willie Clayton. And he has been singing the blues since he was like a little kid and is still singing strong. And he is going to be performing two shows at 5 and 8 p.m. And the concert is actually called Clayton's Father's Day Concert, Father's Day Blues and Soul. And it's also going to be featuring the sultry rhythm blues singer Angela Winbush. So the two of them are going to be performing at the Madam Walker Theater. Two shows, 5 and 8 p.m. on Sunday at Father's Day.
If your dad likes baseball, especially vintage baseball, you know, if you have a dad or let's say a grandfather, even a great-grandfather, who around this time of year you take that person out to an Indians game and at some point after maybe a libation or two, that person says to you, baseball isn't like it used to be. Well, here is the event for you. It's the Vintage Baseball World Series at West Baden Springs, the weekend of June 27th and 28th. Six Midwestern teams will don the vintage uniforms and recreate the language and customs of 19th century baseball while competing in live action games. You can find out more information, even though it's at the West Baden Springs Hotel. Information is available at FrenchLick.com. FrenchLick.com. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, here's something I think any father would enjoy, and that's going to the Phoenix Theater's 14th annual Brouhaha, which is taking place on Saturday, June 27th. So, again, it's after Father's Day, but take your dad to it. It's from 3 to 7, and it's a great event supporting the Phoenix Theater's educational programs. You get to listen to some great live music all afternoon. There's beer and microbrews and craft beers from all sort of the region's brewers. It is rain or shine. There's also a lot of great food from, like, you know, King David's Dogs and Dick's Bodacious Barbecue. I mean, what dad would not
love
that?
Making me hungry.
There you go. So it's on Saturday, June 27th, 3 to 7 at the Phoenix Theater.
Here's something else that you need to make dad a promise. You can't take him to just yet, but you'll be able to maybe buy him some pre-sale tickets and tell him that he is the king of your world and that you want to take him to the King Tut exhibit, which opens on June 27th. And you'll just have a great time. There's all sorts of activities for children of all ages and dads and moms, too, at the King Tut exhibit. Where? At the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. Fabulous, big, splashy, must-see exhibition.
Here's something fun that kids can do with their dads. It's actually coming up on June 28th, and it is the Village of West Clay's 6th annual ice cream social event. It's an all-day event where there is ice cream and bike and car parades and the Carmel Fire Department safe house. There's bocce, there's croquet, all types of things like that. And one of the most exciting things is that there is the West Clay Sidewalk Chalk Contest. And this year, Art and Texture Arts Studio is again sponsoring this contest that's open to residents and non-residents 12 years of age and younger. So if you are 12 or younger, or your child is, take them out there, and they can make some sidewalk chalk art and compete.
Easy
in
for you to say.
That is. And there's also lots of other great activities going on. And again, that is all on June 28th at the Village of West Clay.
Well, you have something else you might want to think about next weekend, the weekend of June 27th and 28th. If your dad likes visual art or likes Native American heritage, you might consider taking him to the 17th annual Idle George Museum Indian Market and Festival. Each of those days, Saturday and Sunday, the 27th and 28th, from 10 to 5, you can do hands-on art activities, you can talk with artists, you can purchase the wares of fine Native American and Western artists, and there's live music and all sorts of dancing and entertainment of all kinds, family activity areas. Just so much to see and do. You can go to idlejorg.org for more information about that cool thing to do with dad.
There you go. Something else you can do with dad is take him to new heights with the Connor Prairie 1859 Balloon Voyage Experience. That has just opened up, and it's really, really cool. It's an old style balloon that goes 350 feet in the air. It is tethered. It's helium filled. You won't float away. They'll pull you back down.
Thank goodness.
And it's part of. They're connected to the story of the first successful airmail delivery in the United States. In the United States, which occurred in Lafayette, Indiana in 1859. The first time airmail was ever delivered in the U.S., Sharon, was here in Indiana.
I love
that. Isn't
that
cool? And it was with a balloon, and so that's how this gets all tied together. But I just think it sounds really fun to, like,
thank goodness
go up
they
in
got
the
a little
balloon.
Faster over the years.
Yeah. So, you know, check out Connor Prairie for if you want to go up in the balloon.
Take your letter up.
You know, and in fact, if you forgot to send your dad a Father's Day card, you could just blame it on the airmail that it's still in the 1859 balloon. There you go.
Okay, one last thing I have on my list that you could take dad to. On Friday night, June 26th, you can go to see Field of Dreams, that 1989 classic, If We Build It, They Will Come. And even if you don't like baseball, you will love Field of Dreams. And it's a great thing for multiple ages to see. Just life-affirming and lovely. And that's at the IMA Summer Nights Film Series at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. You can take a picnic. You can purchase Dad a beer or a glass of wine at the museum. And you can have a great old time with Dad. Boy, if your dad hasn't found something to do today, you're not trying
really
hard enough.
I still got one more thing. You know,
you
if,
got
if,
one more
if,
thing?
If all of
one
this
more?
Doesn't work, then take your dad on Father's Day out to the Warren Performing Arts Center, where they're going to have a big organ concert with the Indianapolis Jazz Orchestra playing
Ooh.
Great Indiana hits. Hoagy Carmichael, Cole Porter. It starts at 2:30 at the Warren Performing Arts Center. Go out there and take your dad to that. He'll love it. What
Excellent.
Dad wouldn't? You know?
That's right.
There you go.
All right. We'll have things that you can do with your dad and maybe some other people next
or
week. Or with
or
us during our birthday month.
Right. When we come back on.
Next week on What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Say that George Rickey started a movement. Well, actually, he started many of them. 10 of the late artist's abstract kinetic sculptures are on view through September 7th throughout downtown Indianapolis. Get it? Many movements, kinetic? Okay. Well, Mindy Taylor-Ross, director of public art for the Arts Council of Indianapolis, came into our studios to tell Sharon Gamble more about George Rickey, his artwork, and why she sometimes has nightmares during windstorms.
I was interested to learn that only Alexander Calder and George Rickey are really known for kinetic sculptures. It feels as though there should have been more sculptors working famously in this mode.
Well, you know, that's an interesting observation. I think the two artists you mentioned, Alexander Calder and George Rickey, are American artists, of course. And mm-hmm. so as Americans, I think we, of course, think of them. But Naum Gabo, a lot of the constructivists, people that came out of Russia and Europe, there were other folks that were working with movement, whether through motors, through the industrial age, experimenting with mechanics and the mechanical age. But in terms of wind, yeah, I mean, Alexander Calder and George Rickey, two American artists, I think are the most prominent.
Rickey has an Indiana start. He was born in South Bend.
George Rickey was born in South Bend, Indiana in 1907. He lived here in Indiana until he was 6 years old. And then his father, who was an engineer for the Singer Sewing Company, I have to say that slow because that always trips me, was transferred then to Scotland. And so George did spend most of his childhood growing up in Scotland, but always seemed to have, as far as I could tell, really a connection to the state. And part of that reason is because, you know, birth is pretty seminal.
Well, yeah.
But he had another seminal time in his life was in 1949 when he was hired as an associate professor at IU Bloomington. So he ended up back in the state later in his life. He was an associate professor down there at the School of Fine Art from 1949 to 1954. And it was during that time that he really found his voice in sculpture. He left painting and drawing, which a lot of people don't realize that George Rickey really was a very traditionally trained artist. He came up in the WPA era, so he was a Works Progress Committee artist who did social realist murals a la Thomas Hart Benton and post offices, and so he really was a painter. And in 49, down in Bloomington, he made his first kinetic sculpture using window glass. And I think IU Bloomington's museum may have one of the only sort of existing kinetic sculptures by George Rickey that incorporates window glass. So that was a very seminal turning point in George's career, which again happened here in Indiana. The other thing that was important was the artist David Smith, who is a contemporary of George Rickey's, and oddly enough, I should note, born 1906 in Decatur, Indiana. So another Hoosier-born sculptor who went on to great international acclaim. David Smith was invited to come to IU Bloomington during that same time period as a visiting artist, and it was during that visit that George and David really got to know each other, and David Smith is credited as giving George some of his first welding lessons.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so there were these things that kept, these seminal occurrences that happened in George's life and career here in the state of Indiana.
Just couldn't stay away. Kept coming back.
No, my husband, who is born and raised here, always tells me that at some point I will realize that all roads do lead back to Indiana.
So let the rest of the world know that, right?
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting that it feels, speaking of circling back, it feels as though George Rickey, by heritage, his father was an engineer for Singer Sewing Machine Company, and a little bit by training, because in World War II, he worked with engineers in a machine shop on aircraft weaponry. So
right.
he had both by nature and nurture,
sure,
that mechanical aptitude, that engineering aptitude. And I'm not saying that you don't need that to be a painter, but it certainly suited him well.
Absolutely. I mean, he was obviously right brain, left brain, and could use both very well. And that's a major difference between Alexander Calder and George Rickey, who you cited in the beginning. Alexander Calder and his kinetic work really came out of a surrealist tradition, which is very emotional and creative. It's really based on impulse, putting forms and colors and things together in a very kind of impulsive, emotional way, very reactionary. Whereas George Rickey, because of that other side of his brain that really understood and embraced engineering, mechanical, industrial sort of thought processes, he really comes out of that constructivist tradition I talked about before, and kind of Bauhaus and these movements that were really, at least initially, you know, coming out of Europe and out of the East. And so his work is really about thought process and about craft and about just sort of process in general. It is an art of ideas where form is really pared down, and it's about... and this is what makes George's work truly unique. The work is really about the movement. It really is about it's not about the form. It's not about the material. It's about the movement. So, yes, it is interesting. And actually, his grandfather was a clockmaker. So he really did from this lineage of engineers. And he's noted as talking about the first time he realized that he was going to find his way back, I think, to engineering and to physics and aerodynamics, was he grew up sailing off the shore of Scotland. And so learning how a boat reacts to the wind, I think, was the first time he kind of noticed that was interesting to him. And like most of us in life, you know, these things become recurring enough that you start to pay attention to them and say, okay, something's there. And I think that's truly what happened to him.
Now, obviously, every time you figure out, every time you decide what kind of public art to pursue, you already have some venues in mind. In this case, I'm picturing, and tell me if this was a factor, deciding where these sculptures would go. Did you have to take the wind factor into consideration?
That's a great question, actually, and I'm getting asked that quite a bit by folks as I run into people in the streets. It wasn't, simply because in downtown, we tend to put the sculptures out in street corners anyway, because mm-hmm. we put things out in the public right-of-way where people can really enjoy them as part of their daily lives without necessarily having to seek them out. And by doing that, the way our downtown is built, of course, with the size skyscrapers and everything else, the streets really become wind tunnels anyway.
Sure.
So I kind of knew naturally that being put out on street corners, they would get sufficient wind. So we didn't have to take that too much into consideration. The main thing I had to take into consideration is because they form these wind tunnels between the high rises, is if the sculptures could take it.
Yeah.
Because, of course, a few years ago, we famously had the straight line winds downtown, which blew out one of the bank buildings and caused the round doors at Chase Tower to shatter.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the kinetic sculptures downtown are engineered to withstand 80-mile-an-hour wind gusts. So so far, although I have to say, last week when we had some storms, I did wake up in the middle of the night and I thought, oh my gosh,
do I need
George
to run
Ricky
downtown
sculptures?
And check my sculptures?
Yeah, that are like flipping down the street or something. But everything's
so far so good.
So far so good. Everything's fine.
I'm glad you have your job and I don't have your job. I don't have the physics background to deal with that. Have you obviously they've been up for a little bit as we're having this conversation. Do you go spy on people who are looking at public art?
I do. Like a visual artist, I tend to be a little faceless. Like, a lot of people don't know what I look like. See, mm-hmm. I do radio interviews.
That's right.
And so, yeah, I can kind of, as I'm walking around at lunchtime downtown and things like that, I can go and kind of hang out by the sculpture and listen to people or just watch them and see how they might be reacting. The great thing about George's work is, like a lot of the shows I've done, I try to select these things, the artist and the work, so that there are a lot of portals of entry for people. There are lots of different ways, hopefully, people can engage with the work and potentially understand the work or appreciate the work, or, of course, not. Everyone's always allowed to not like it. That's totally fine as long as they've considered it. I'm great with that. And so with George, I think you can really enjoy it aesthetically. I think they're very lyrical. They're very beautiful.
They're playful.
You can enjoy it strictly for the movement. People are usually amazed when they realize that there are no motors involved. So then people, a lot of men have come up to me and said that they really enjoy thinking about them from an engineering perspective, from kind of a physics. People who, wouldn't necessarily call themselves art folks, can enter it from sort of a math science, way. So there's lots of different ways that I am hearing that people are looking at them and enjoying them.
Do you have a favorite piece or a favorite piece in a particular location?
I do. I have a couple. I can never just pick one for some reason. I really love Three Squares Gyratory, which is installed on the south side of the City County building at the corner of Washington and Delaware Streets. Love our city, but that City County building is difficult. That is a brutalist piece of architecture. And so there are bookends at either side of the City County building on that block, and one bookend has a sculpture, and the other bookend doesn't. And so I've always wanted to put something there, but it's difficult to find something that will really hold up to that building, and I think that sculpture is really great there. The geometric forms, I think, work with that site, work with the building, but it softens it because, again, George's movement is so beautiful and so soft and so delicate that
it's a good compliment to that monolith.
It sings against that monolith, so it's really, really great. I also love the Column of Four Squares by the Broadbent Building by Fogo de Chao at Washington and Penn. To me, it's like a jazz ensemble. Those squares really show how, as George went on in his career, the forms got simpler, but the movement got much more complex. And those different squares, those four squares, move so well on their own and against each other that it's like a jazz improv, it's like improv watching that piece move. And then the third piece I love is the Breaking Column, which is located at Capitol Commons behind the Simon Headquarters building. Again, such a minimalist, beautiful form. You can think of the column of a piece of architecture, yet as the wind moves it, it starts to deconstruct, and you really never see it the same way twice. So simple form, complex movement. I also think it's important to see some of George's work in green space. They really kind of sing in green space, even though what we do here is urban exhibitions. And I do think it's important to note, we brought this show to Indianapolis. It was George's son and I curated the show, and this is the largest urban exhibition of George's show of the monumental work in an urban environment. This is really the first time that's ever occurred. So we're all pretty proud of that.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. We're all pretty proud. Well, the city should be proud of it. I mean, we're doing a lot of things here that other cities aren't doing, and I'm not sure people know that. So it's great, and people are really looking at what we're doing, and asking why Indianapolis, and we're fortunate to be able to say, well, why not?
Why not?
So it's good.
Sharon Gamble with Mindy Taylor Ross, Director of Public Art for the Arts Council of Indianapolis.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 p.m. I'll have three very different interviews, one about Indiana artists, one about the secret life of everyday objects, and one about King Tut.
It's an all Sharon show with King Tut's everyday objects in Indiana.
That's right. You got it.
There you go. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.